valued her good opinion, and I was afraid of losing it if I told her all the particulars of my sad story. But now I felt that it was necessary for her to know how I was situated. I had once left her abruptly, without explaining the reason, and it would not be proper to do it again. I went home, resolved to tell her in the morning. But the sadness of my face attracted her attention, and, in answer to her kind inquiries, I poured out my full heart to her before bedtime. She listened with true womanly sympathy, and told me she would do all she could to protect me. How my heart blessed her. Early the next morning, Judge Vanderpool and Lawyer Hopper were consulted. They said I had better leave the city at once, as the risk would be too great if the case came to trial. Mrs. Bruce took me in a carriage to the house of one of her friends, where she assured me I should be safe until my brother could arrive, which would be in a few days. In the interval, my thoughts were much occupied with Ellen. She was mine by birth, and she was also mine by Southern law, since my grandmother held the bill of sale that made her so. I did not feel that she was safe unless I had her with me. Mrs. Hobbs, who felt badly about her brother's treachery, yielded to my entreaties, on condition that she should return in 10 days. I avoided making any promise. She came to me clad in very thin garments, all outgrown, and with a school satchel on her arm, containing a few articles. It was late in October, and I knew the child must suffer. And not daring to go out in the streets to purchase anything, I took off my own flannel skirt and converted it into one for her. Kind Mrs. Bruce came to bid me goodbye, and when she saw that I had taken off my clothing for my child, the tears came to her eyes. She said, "Wait for me, Linda," and went out. She soon returned with a nice warm shawl and hood for Ellen. Truly, of such souls as hers are the kingdom of heaven. My brother reached New York on Wednesday. Lawyer Hopper advised us to go to Boston by the Stonington route, as there was less southern travel in that direction. Mrs. Bruce directed her servants to tell all inquirers that I formerly lived there, but had gone from the city. We reached the steamboat, Rhode Island, in safety. That boat employed colored hands, but I knew that colored passengers were not admitted to the cabin. I was very desirous for the seclusion of the cabin, not only on account of exposure to the night air, but also to avoid observation. Lawyer Hopper was waiting on board for us. He spoke to the stewardess and asked as a particular favor that she would treat us well. He said to me, "Go and speak to the captain yourself by and by. Take your little girl with you, and I am sure he will not let her sleep on deck." With these kind words and a shake of the hand, he departed. The boat was soon on her way, bearing me rapidly from the friendly home where I had hoped to find security and rest. My brother had left me to purchase the tickets, thinking that I might have better success than he would. When the stewardess came to me, I paid what she asked, and she gave me 3 tickets with clipped corners. In the most unsophisticated manner, I said, "You have made a mistake. I asked you for cabin tickets. I cannot possibly consent to sleep on deck with my little daughter." She assured me there was no mistake. She said on some of the routes colored people were allowed to sleep in the cabin, but not on this route, which was much traveled by the wealthy. I asked her to show me to the captain's office, and she said she would after tea. When the time came, I took Ellen by the hand and went to the captain, politely requesting him to change our tickets, as we should be very uncomfortable on deck. He said it was contrary to their custom, but he would see that we had berths below. He would also try to obtain comfortable seats for us in the cars. Of that he was not certain, but he would speak to the conductor about it when the boat arrived. I thanked him and returned to the ladies' cabin. He came afterwards and told me that the conductor of the cars was on board, that he had spoken to him, and he had promised to take care of us. I was very much surprised at receiving so much kindness. I don't know whether the pleasing face of my little girl had won his heart, or whether the stewardess inferred from Lawyer Hopper's manner that I was a fugitive and had pleaded with him in my behalf. When the boat arrived at Stonington, the conductor kept his promise and showed us to seats in the first car nearest the engine. He asked us to take seats next to the door, but as he passed through, we ventured to move on toward the other end of the car. No incivility was offered us, and we reached Boston in safety. The day after my arrival was one of the happiest of my life. I felt as if I was beyond the reach of the bloodhounds, and for the first time during many years, I had both my children together with me. They greatly enjoyed their reunion and laughed and chatted merrily. I watched them with a swelling heart. Their every motion delighted me. I could not feel safe in New York, and I accepted the offer of a friend that we should share expenses and keep house together. I represented to Mrs. Hobbs that Ellen must have some schooling and must remain with me for that purpose. She felt ashamed of being unable to read or spell at her age, so instead of sending her to school with Benny, I instructed her myself till she was fitted to enter an intermediate school. The winter passed pleasantly, while I was busy with my needle and my children with their books. 37. A Visit to England. In the spring, sad news came to me. Mrs. Bruce was dead. Never again in this world should I see her gentle face or hear her sympathizing voice. I had lost an excellent friend, and little Mary had lost a tender mother. Mr. Bruce wished the child to visit some of her mother's relatives in England, and he was desirous that I should take charge of her. The little motherless one was accustomed to me and attached to me, and I thought she would be happier in my care than in that of a stranger. I could also earn more in this way than I could by my needle. So I put Benny to a trade and left Ellen to remain in the house with my friend and go to school. We sailed from New York and arrived in Liverpool after a pleasant voyage of 12 days. We proceeded directly to London and took lodgings at the Adelaide Hotel. The supper seemed to me less luxurious than those I had seen in American hotels, but my situation was indescribably more pleasant. For the first time in my life, I was in a place where I was treated according to my deportment, without reference to my complexion. I felt as if a great millstone had been lifted from my breast. Ensconced in a pleasant room with my dear little charge, I laid my head on my pillow for the first time with a delightful consciousness of pure, unadulterated freedom. As I had constant care of the child, I had little opportunity to see the wonders of that great city. But I watched the tide of life that flowed through the streets and found it a strange contrast to the stagnation in our southern towns. Mr. Bruce took his little daughter to spend some days with friends in Oxford Crescent, and of course it was necessary for me to accompany her. I had heard much of the systematic method of English education, and I was very desirous that my dear Mary should steer straight in the midst of so much propriety. I closely observed her little playmates and their nurses, being ready to take any lessons in the science of good management. The children were more rosy than American children, but I did not see that they differed materially in other respects. They were like all children, sometimes docile and sometimes wayward. We next went to Steventon, in Berkshire. It was a small town, said to be the poorest in the county. I saw men working in the fields for 6 shillings and 7 shillings a week, and women for 6 pence and 7 pence a day out of which they boarded themselves. Of course, they lived in the most primitive manner. It could not be otherwise, where a woman's wages for an entire day were not sufficient to buy a pound of meat. They paid very low rents, and their clothes were made of the cheapest fabrics, though much better than could have been procured in the United States for the same money. I had heard much about the oppression of the poor in Europe. The people I saw around me were, many of them, among the poorest poor. But when I visited them in their little thatched cottages, I felt that the condition of even the meanest and most ignorant among them was vastly superior to the condition of the most favored slaves in America. They labored hard, but they were not ordered out to toil while the stars were in the sky and driven and slashed by an overseer through heat and cold till the stars shone out again. Their homes were very humble, but they were protected by law. No insolent patrols could come in the dead of night and flog them at their pleasure. The father, when he closed his cottage door, felt safe with his family around him. No master or overseer could come and take from him his wife or his daughter. They must separate to earn their living, but the parents knew where their children were going and could communicate with them by letters. The relations of husband and wife, parent and child, were too sacred for the richest noble in the land to violate with impunity. Much was being done to enlighten these poor people. Schools were established among them, and benevolent societies were active in efforts to ameliorate their condition. There was no law forbidding them to learn to read and write. And if they helped each other in spelling out the Bible, they were in no danger of 39 lashes, as was the case with myself and poor pious old Uncle Fred. I repeat that the most ignorant and the most destitute of these peasants was a thousandfold better off than the most pampered American slave. I do not deny that the poor are oppressed in Europe. I am not disposed to paint their condition so rose-colored as the Honorable Miss Murray paints the condition of the slaves in the United States. A small portion of my experience would enable her to read her own pages with anointed eyes. If she were to lay aside her title, and instead of visiting among the fashionable, become domesticated as a poor governess on some plantation in Louisiana or Alabama, she would see and hear things that would make her tell quite a different story. My visit to England is a memorable event in my life, from the fact of my having there received strong religious impressions. The contemptuous manner in which the communion had been administered to colored people in my native place, the church membership of Dr. Flint and others like him, and the buying and selling of slaves by professed ministers of the gospel, had given me a prejudice against the Episcopal Church. The whole service seemed to me a mockery and a sham. But my home in Steventon was in the family of a clergyman who was a true disciple of Jesus. The beauty of his daily life inspired me with faith in the genuineness of Christian professions. Grace entered my heart, and I knelt at the communion table, I trust, in true humility of soul. I remained abroad 10 months, which was much longer than I had anticipated. During all that time, I never saw the slightest symptom of prejudice against color. Indeed, I entirely forgot it till the time came for us to return to America. 38. Renewed invitations to go south. We had a tedious winter passage, and from the distance specters seemed to rise up on the shores of the United States. It is a sad feeling to be afraid of one's native country. We arrived in New York safely, and I hastened to Boston to look after my children. I found Ellen well and improving at her school, but Benny was not there to welcome me. He had been left at a good place to learn a trade, and for several months everything worked well. He was liked by the master and was a favorite with his fellow apprentices. But one day they accidentally discovered a fact they had never before suspected, that he was colored. This at once transformed him into a different being. Some of the apprentices were Americans, others American-born Irish, and it was offensive to their dignity to have a nigger among them, after they had been told that he was a nigger. They began by treating him with silent scorn, and finding that he returned the same, they resorted to insults and abuse. He was too spirited a boy to stand that, and he went off. Being desirous to do something to support himself, and having no one to advise him, he shipped for a whaling voyage. When I received these tidings, I shed many tears and bitterly reproached myself for having left him so long. But I had done it for the best, and now all I could do was to pray to the Heavenly Father to guide and protect him. Not long after my return, I received the following letter from Miss Emily Flint, now Mrs. Dodge. In this you will recognize the hand of your friend and mistress. Having heard that you had gone with a family to Europe, I have waited to hear of your return to write to you. I should have answered the letter you wrote to me long since, but as I could not then act independently of my father, I knew there could be nothing done satisfactory to you. There were persons here who were willing to buy you and run the risk of getting you. To this I would not consent. I have always been attached to you and would not like to see you the slave of another or have unkind treatment. I am married now and can protect you. My husband expects to move to Virginia this spring, where we think of settling. I am very anxious that you should come and live with me. If you are not willing to come, you may purchase yourself, but I should prefer having you live with me. If you come, you may, if you like, spend a month with your grandmother and friends, then come over to me in Norfolk, Virginia. Think this over, and write as soon as possible, and let me know the conclusion. Hoping that your children are well, I remain your friend and mistress. Of course, I did not write to return thanks for this cordial invitation. I felt insulted to be thought stupid enough to be caught by such professions. "Come up into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. "'Tis the prettiest little parlor that ever you did spy." It was plain that Dr. Flint's family were apprised of my movements, since they knew of my voyage to Europe. I expected to have further trouble from them, but having eluded them thus far, I hoped to be as successful in the future. The money I had earned, I was desirous to devote to the education of my children and to secure a home for them. It seemed not only hard, but unjust to pay for myself. I could not possibly regard myself as a piece of property. Moreover, I had worked many years without wages, and during that time had been obliged to depend on my grandmother for many comforts in food and clothing. My children certainly belonged to me. But though Dr. Flint had incurred no expense for their support, he had received a large sum of money for them. I knew the law would decide that I was his property, and would probably still give his daughter a claim to my children. But I regarded such laws as the regulations of robbers, who had no rights that I was bound to respect. The fugitive slave law had not then passed. The judges of Massachusetts had not then stooped under chains to enter her courts of justice, so-called. I knew my old master was rather skittish of Massachusetts. I relied on her love of freedom and felt safe on her soil. I am now aware that I honored the old Commonwealth beyond her deserts. 39. The Confession. For 2 years, my daughter and I supported ourselves comfortably in Boston. At the end of that time, my brother William offered to send Ellen to a boarding school. It required a great effort for me to consent to part with her, for I had few near ties, and it was her presence that made my two little rooms seem homelike. But my judgment prevailed over my selfish feelings. I made preparations for her departure. During the 2 years we had lived together, I had often resolved to tell her something about her father, but I had never been able to muster sufficient courage. I had a shrinking dread of diminishing my child's love. I knew she must have curiosity on the subject, but she had never asked a question. She was always very careful not to say anything to remind me of my troubles. Now that she was going from me, I thought if I should die before she returned, she might hear my story from someone who did not understand the palliating circumstances, and that if she were entirely ignorant on the subject, her sensitive nature might receive a rude shock. When we retired for the night, she said, "Mother, it is very hard to leave you alone. I am almost sorry I am going, though I do want to improve myself. But you will write to me often, won't you, Mother?" I did not throw my arms round her. I did not answer her. But in a calm, solemn way, for it cost me great effort, I said, "Listen to me, Ellen. I have something to tell you." I recounted my early sufferings in slavery and told her how nearly they had crushed me. I began to tell her how they had driven me into a great sin when she clasped me in her arms and exclaimed, "Oh, don't, Mother, please don't tell me any more." I said, "But my child, I want you to know about your father." "I know all about it, Mother," she replied. "I am nothing to my father, and he is nothing to me. All my love is for you. I was with him 5 months in Washington, and he never cared for me. He never spoke to me as he did to his little Fanny. I knew all the time he was my father, for Fanny's nurse told me so, but she said I must never tell anybody, and I never did. I used to wish he would take me in his arms and kiss me as he did Fanny, or that he would sometimes smile at me as he did at her. I thought if he was my own father, he ought to love me. I was a little girl then and didn't know any better. But now I never think anything about my father. All my love is for you." She hugged me closer as she spoke, and I thanked God that the knowledge I had so much dreaded to impart had not diminished the affection of my child. I had not the slightest idea she knew that portion of my history. If I had, I should have spoken to her long before, for my pent-up feelings had often longed to pour themselves out to someone I could trust. But I loved the dear girl better for the delicacy she had manifested towards her unfortunate mother. The next morning, she and her uncle started on their journey to the village in New York, where she was to be placed at school. It seemed as if all the sunshine had gone away. My little room was dreadfully lonely. I was thankful when a message came from a lady, accustomed to employ me, requesting me to come and sew in her family for several weeks. On my return, I found a letter from Brother William. He thought of opening an anti-slavery reading room in Rochester, and combining with it the sale of some books and stationery, and he wanted me to unite with him. We tried it, but it was not successful. We found warm anti-slavery friends there, but the feeling was not general enough to support such an establishment. I passed nearly a year in the family of Isaac and Amy Post, practical believers in the Christian doctrine of human brotherhood. They measure a man's worth by his character, not by his complexion. The memory of those beloved and honored friends will remain with me to my latest hour. 40. The Fugitive Slave Law. My brother, being disappointed in his project, concluded to go to California, and it was agreed that Benjamin should go with him. Ellen liked her school and was a great favorite there. They did not know her history, and she did not tell it, because she had no desire to make capital out of their sympathy. But when it was accidentally discovered that her mother was a fugitive slave, every method was used to increase her advantages and diminish her expenses. I was alone again. It was necessary for me to be earning money, and I preferred that it should be among those who knew me. On my return from Rochester, I called at the house of Mr. Bruce to see Mary, the darling little babe that had thawed my heart when it was freezing into a cheerless distrust of all my fellow beings. She was growing a tall girl now, but I loved her always. Mr. Bruce had married again, and it was proposed that I should become nurse to a new infant. I had but one hesitation, and that was feeling of insecurity in New York, now greatly increased by the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law. However, I resolved to try the experiment. I was again fortunate in my employer. The new Mrs. Bruce was an American, brought up under aristocratic influences, and still living in the midst of them. But if she had any prejudice against color, I was never made aware of it. And as for the system of slavery, she had a most hearty dislike of it. No sophistry of Southerners could blind her to its enormity. She was a person of excellent principles and a noble heart. To me, from that hour to the present, she has been a true and sympathizing friend. Blessings be with her and hers. About the time that I re-entered the Bruce family, an event occurred of disastrous import to the colored people. The slave Hamlin, the first fugitive that came under the new law, was given up by the bloodhounds of the North to the bloodhounds of the South. It was the beginning of a reign of terror to the colored population. The great city rushed on its whirl of excitement, taking no note of the short and simple annals of the poor. But while fashionables were listening to the thrilling voice of Jenny Lind in Metropolitan Hall, the thrilling voices of poor hunted colored people went up in an agony of supplication to the Lord from Zion's church. Many families who had lived in the city for 20 years fled from it now. Many a poor washerwoman who by hard labor had made herself a comfortable home was obliged to sacrifice her furniture, bid a hurried farewell to friends, and seek her fortune among strangers in Canada. Many a wife discovered a secret she had never known before, that her husband was a fugitive and must leave her to ensure his own safety. Worse still, many a husband discovered that his wife had fled from slavery years ago, and as the child follows the condition of its mother, the children of his love were liable to be seized and carried into slavery. Everywhere, in those humble homes, there was consternation and anguish. But what cared the legislators of the dominant race for the blood they were crushing out of trampled hearts? When my brother William spent his last evening with me, before he went to California, we talked nearly all the time of the distress brought on our oppressed people by the passage of this iniquitous law. And never had I seen him manifest such bitterness of spirit, such stern hostility to our oppressors. He was himself free from the operation of the law, for he did not run from any slaveholding state, being brought into the free states by his master. But I was subject to it, and so were hundreds of intelligent and industrious people all around us. I seldom ventured into the streets, and when it was necessary to do an errand for Mrs. Bruce or any of the family, I went as much as possible through back streets and byways. What a disgrace to a city calling itself free, that inhabitants, guiltless of offense and seeking to perform their duties conscientiously, should be condemned to live in such incessant fear and have nowhere to turn for protection. This state of things, of course, gave rise to many impromptu vigilance committees. Every colored person and every friend of their persecuted race kept their eyes wide open. Every evening, I examined the newspapers carefully to see what Southerners had put up at the hotels. I did this for my own sake, thinking my young mistress and her husband might be among the list. I wished also to give information to others if necessary. For if many were running to and fro, I resolved that knowledge should be increased. This brings up one of my Southern reminiscences, which I will here briefly relate. I was somewhat acquainted with a slave named Luke, who belonged to a wealthy man in our vicinity. His master died, leaving a son and daughter heirs to his large fortune. In the division of the slaves, Luke was included in the son's portion. This young man became a prey to the vices. He went to the North to complete his education. He carried his vices with him. He was brought home, deprived of the use of his limbs by excessive dissipation. Luke was appointed to wait upon his bedridden master, whose despotic habits were greatly increased by exasperation at his own helplessness. He kept a cowhide beside him, and for the most trivial occurrence, he would order his attendant to bare his back and kneel beside the couch while he whipped him till his strength was exhausted. Some days he was not allowed to wear anything but his shirt in order to be in readiness to be flogged. A day seldom passed without his receiving more or less blows. If the slightest resistance was offered, the town constable was sent for to execute the punishment. And Luke learned from experience how much more the constable's strong arm was to be dreaded than the comparatively feeble one of his master. The arm of his tyrant grew weaker and was finally palsied. And then the constable's services were in constant requisition. The fact that he was entirely dependent on Luke's care and was obliged to be tended like an infant, instead of inspiring any gratitude or compassion towards his poor slave, seemed only to increase his irritability and cruelty. As he lay there on his bed, a mere degraded wreck of manhood, he took into his head the strangest freaks of despotism. And if Luke hesitated to submit to his orders, the constable was immediately sent for. Some of these freaks were of a nature too filthy to be repeated. When I fled from the house of bondage, I left poor Luke still chained to the bedside of this cruel and disgusting wretch. One day, when I had been requested to do an errand for Mrs. Bruce, I was hurrying through back streets as usual, when I saw a young man approaching, whose face was familiar to me. As he came nearer, I recognized Luke. I always rejoiced to see or hear of anyone who had escaped from the black pit. I was peculiarly glad to see him on northern soil, though I no longer called it free soil. I well remembered what a desolate feeling it was to be alone among strangers, and I went up to him and greeted him cordially. At first, he did not know me, but when I mentioned my name, he remembered all about me. I told him of the fugitive slave law and asked him if he did not know that New York was a city of kidnappers. He replied, "De risk ain't so bad for me as 'tis for you. 'Cause I runned away from de speculator, and you runned away from de massa. Dem speculators won't spend their money to come here for a runaway if they ain't certain sure to put their hands right on him. And I tell you, I's took good care about that. I had two hard times down there to let him catch this nigger." He then told me of the advice he had received and the plans he had laid. I asked if he had money enough to take him to Canada. "Pinned upon it I have," he replied. "I took care for that. I've been working all my days for them cussed whites and got no pay but kicks and cuffs. So I taught this nigger how to write the money enough to bring him to the free states. Master Henry, he lived till everybody wish him dead. And when he did die, I know the devil would have him, and wouldn't want him to bring his money along too. So I took some of his bills and put them in the pocket of his old trousers. And when he was buried, this nigger asked for them old trousers, and they gave them to me." With a low chuckling laugh, he added, "You see, I didn't steal it. They gave it to me. I tell you, I had mighty hard time to keep the speculator from finding it, but he didn't get it." This is a fair specimen of how the moral sense is educated by slavery. When a man has his wages stolen from him year after year, and the laws sanction and enforce the theft, how can he be expected to have more regard to honesty than has the man who robs him? I have become somewhat enlightened, but I confess that I agree with poor, ignorant, much abused Luke in thinking that he had a right to that money as a portion of his unpaid wages. He went to Canada forthwith, and I have not since heard from him. All that winter, I lived in a state of anxiety. When I took the children out to breathe the air, I closely observed the countenances of all I met. I dreaded the approach of summer, when snakes and slaveholders make their appearance. I was, in fact, a slave in New York, as subject to slave laws as I had been in a slave state. Strange incongruity in a state called free. Spring returned, and I received warning from the South that Dr. Flint knew of my return to my old place and was making preparations to have me caught. I learned afterwards that my dress and that of Mrs. Bruce's children had been described to him by some of the northern tools which slaveholders employ for their base purposes, and then indulge in sneers at their cupidity and mean servility. I immediately informed Mrs. Bruce of my danger, and she took prompt measures for my safety. My place as nurse could not be supplied immediately, and this generous, sympathizing lady proposed that I should carry her baby away. It was a comfort to me to have the child with me, for the heart is reluctant to be torn away from every object it loves. But how few mothers would have consented to have one of their own babes become a fugitive for the sake of a poor, hunted nurse, on whom the legislators of the country had let loose the bloodhounds. When I spoke of the sacrifice she was making in depriving herself of her dear baby, she replied, "It is better for you to have baby with you, Linda. For if they get on your track, they will be obliged to bring the child to me. And then, if there is a possibility of saving you, you shall be saved." This lady had a very wealthy relative, a benevolent gentleman in many respects, but aristocratic and pro-slavery. He remonstrated with her for harboring a fugitive slave, told her she was violating the laws of her country, and asked her if she was aware of the penalty. She replied, "I am very well aware of it. It is imprisonment and $1,000 fine. Shame on my country that it is so. I'm ready to incur the penalty. I will go to the state's prison rather than have any poor victim torn from my house to be carried back to slavery." The noble heart, the brave heart, the tears are in my eyes while I write of her. May the God of the helpless reward her for her sympathy with my persecuted people. I was sent into New England, where I was sheltered by the wife of a senator, whom I shall always hold in grateful remembrance. This honorable gentleman would not have voted for the fugitive slave law, as did the senator in Uncle Tom's cabin. On the contrary, he was strongly opposed to it, but he was enough under its influence to be afraid of having me remain in his house many hours. So I was sent into the country, where I remained a month with a baby. When it was supposed that Dr. Flint's emissaries had lost track of me and given up the pursuit for the present, I returned to New York. 41. Free at last. Mrs. Bruce and every member of her family were exceedingly kind to me. I was thankful for the blessings of my lot, yet I could not always wear a cheerful countenance. I was doing harm to no one. On the contrary, I was doing all the good I could in my small way. Yet I could never go out to breathe God's free air without trepidation at my heart. This seemed hard, and I could not think it was a right state of things in any civilized country. From time to time, I received news from my good old grandmother. She could not write, but she employed others to write for her. The following is an extract from one of her last letters. "Dear daughter, I cannot hope to see you again on earth, but I pray to God to unite us above, where pain will no more rack this feeble body of mine, where sorrow and parting from my children will be no more. God has promised these things if we are faithful unto the end. My age and feeble health deprive me of going to church now, but God is with me here at home. Thank your brother for his kindness. Give much love to him, and tell him to remember the Creator in the days of his youth, and strive to meet me in the Father's kingdom. Love to Ellen and Benjamin. Don't neglect him. Tell him for me to be a good boy. Strive, my child, to train them for God's children. May he protect and provide for you, is the prayer of your loving old mother." These letters both cheered and saddened me. I was always glad to have tidings from the kind, faithful old friend of my unhappy youth. But her messages of love made my heart yearn to see her before she died, and I mourned over the fact that it was impossible. Some months after I returned from my flight to New England, I received a letter from her, in which she wrote, "Dr. Flint is dead. He has left a distressed family. Poor old man. I hope he made his peace with God." I remembered how he had defrauded my grandmother of the hard earnings she had loaned, how he had tried to cheat her out of the freedom her mistress had promised her, and how he had persecuted her children. And I thought to myself that she was a better Christian than I was, if she could entirely forgive him. I cannot say with truth that the news of my old master's death softened my feelings towards him. There are wrongs which even the grave does not bury. The man was odious to me while he lived, and his memory is odious now. His departure from this world did not diminish my danger. He had threatened my grandmother that his heirs should hold me in slavery after he was gone, that I never should be free so long as a child of his survived. As for Mrs. Flint, I had seen her in deeper afflictions than I supposed the loss of her husband would be, for she had buried several children. Yet I never saw any signs of softening in her heart. The doctor had died in embarrassed circumstances and had little to will to his heirs, except such property as he was unable to grasp. I was well aware what I had to expect from the family of Flint's, and my fears were confirmed by a letter from the South warning me to be on my guard, because Mrs. Flint openly declared that her daughter could not afford to lose so valuable a slave as I was. I kept close watch of the newspapers for arrivals, but one Saturday night, being much occupied, I forgot to examine the Evening Express as usual. I went down into the parlor for it early in the morning and found the boy about to kindle a fire with it. I took it from him and examined the list of arrivals. Reader, if you have never been a slave, you cannot imagine the acute sensation of suffering at my heart when I read the names of Mr. and Mrs. Dodge at a hotel in Cortlandt Street. It was a third-rate hotel, and that circumstance convinced me of the truth of what I had heard, that they were short of funds and had need of my value, as they valued me, and that was by dollars and cents. I hastened with the paper to Mrs. Bruce. Her heart and hand were always open to everyone in distress, and she always warmly sympathized with mine. It was impossible to tell how near the enemy was. He might have passed and repassed the house while we were sleeping. He might at that moment be waiting to pounce upon me if I ventured out of doors. I had never seen the husband of my young mistress, and therefore I could not distinguish him from any other stranger. A carriage was hastily ordered, and closely veiled, I followed Mrs. Bruce, taking the baby again with me into exile. After various turnings and crossings and returnings, the carriage stopped at the house of one of Mrs. Bruce's friends, where I was kindly received. Mrs. Bruce returned immediately to instruct the domestics what to say if anyone came to inquire for me. It was lucky for me that the evening paper was not burned up before I had a chance to examine the list of arrivals. It was not long after Mrs. Bruce's return to her house before several people came to inquire for me. One inquired for me, another asked for my daughter, Ellen, and another said he had a letter from my grandmother, which he was requested to deliver in person. They were told, "She has lived here, but she has left." "How long ago?"
"I don't know, sir."
"Do you know where she went?"
"I do not, sir."
And the door was closed. This Mr. Dodge, who claimed me as his property, was originally a Yankee peddler in the South. Then he became a merchant, and finally a slaveholder. He managed to get introduced into what was called the First Society and married Miss Emily Flint. A quarrel arose between him and her brother, and the brother cowhided him. This led to a family feud, and he proposed to remove to Virginia. Dr. Flint left him no property, and his own means had become circumscribed, while a wife and children depended upon him for support. Under these circumstances, it was very natural that he should make an effort to put me into his pocket. I had a colored friend, a man from my native place, in whom I had the most implicit confidence. I sent for him and told him that Mr. and Mrs. Dodge had arrived in New York. I proposed that he should call upon them to make inquiries about his friends at the South, with whom Dr. Flint's family were well acquainted. He thought there was no impropriety in his doing so, and he consented. He went to the hotel and knocked at the door of Mr. Dodge's room, which was opened by the gentleman himself, who gruffly inquired, "What brought you here? How came you to know I was in the city?" "Your arrival was published in the evening papers, sir, and I called to ask Mrs. Dodge about my friends at home. I didn't suppose it would give any offense." "Where's that Negro girl that belongs to my wife?" "What girl, sir?" "You know well enough. I mean Linda, that ran away from Dr. Flynn's plantation some years ago. I didn't say you've seen her and know where she is." "Yes, sir, I've seen her, and know where she is. She's out of your reach, sir." "Tell me where she is, or bring her to me, and I will give her a chance to buy her freedom." "I don't think it would be of any use, sir. I have heard her say she would go to the ends of the earth rather than pay any man or woman for her freedom, because she thinks she has a right to it. Besides, she couldn't do it if she would, for she has spent her earnings to educate her children." This made Mr. Dodge very angry, and some high words passed between them. My friend was afraid to come where I was, but in the course of the day I received a note from him. I supposed they had not come from the South, in the winter, for a pleasure excursion, and now the nature of their business was very plain. Mrs. Bruce came to me and entreated me to leave the city the next morning. She said her house was watched, and it was possible that some clue to me might be obtained. I refused to take her advice. She pleaded with an earnest tenderness that ought to have moved me, but I was in a bitter, disheartened mood. I was weary of flying from pillar to post. I had been chased during half my life, and it seemed as if the chase was never to end. There I sat, in that great city, guiltless of crime, yet not daring to worship God in any of the churches. I heard the bells ringing for afternoon service, and with contemptuous sarcasm I said, "Will the preachers take for their text, 'Proclaim liberty to the captive and the opening of prison doors to them that are bound'? Or will they preach from the text, 'Do unto others as ye would they should do unto you'? Oppressed Poles and Hungarians could find a safe refuge in that city. John Mitchell was free to proclaim in the city hall his desire for a plantation well stocked with slaves. But there I sat, an oppressed American, not daring to show my face. God forgive the black and bitter thoughts I indulged on that Sabbath day. The scripture says, 'Oppression makes even a wise man mad.' And I was not wise." I had been told that Mr. Dodge, said his wife, had never signed away her right to my children, and if he could not get me, he would take them. This it was, more than anything else, that roused such a tempest in my soul. Benjamin was with his Uncle William in California, but my innocent young daughter had come home to spend a vacation with me. I thought of what I had suffered in slavery at her age, and my heart was like a tiger's when a hunter tries to seize her young. Dear Mrs. Bruce, I seemed to see the expression of her face as she turned away discouraged by my obstinate mood. Finding her expostulations unavailing, she sent Ellen to entreat me. When 10 o'clock in the evening arrived, and Ellen had not returned, this watchful and unwearied friend became anxious. She came to us in a carriage, bringing a well-filled trunk for my journey, trusting that by this time I would listen to reason. I yielded to her, as I ought to have done before. The next day, Baby and I set out in a heavy snowstorm, bound for New England again. I received letters from the City of Iniquity, addressed to me under an assumed name. In a few days, one came from Mrs. Bruce, informing me that my new master was still searching for me, and that she intended to put an end to this persecution by buying my freedom. I felt grateful for the kindness that prompted this offer, but the idea was not so pleasant to me as might have been expected. The more my mind had become enlightened, the more difficult it was for me to consider myself an article of property. And to pay money to those who had so grievously oppressed me seemed like taking from my sufferings the glory of triumph. I wrote to Mrs. Bruce, thanking her, but saying that being sold from one owner to another seemed too much like slavery, that such a great obligation could not be easily canceled, and that I preferred to go to my brother in California. Without my knowledge, Mrs. Bruce employed a gentleman in New York to enter into negotiations with Mr. Dodge. He proposed to pay $300 down, if Mr. Dodge would sell me and enter into obligations to relinquish all claim to me or my children forever after. He who called himself my master said he scorned so small an offer for such a valuable servant. The gentleman replied, "You can do as you choose, sir. If you reject this offer, you will never get anything, for the woman has friends who will convey her and her children out of the country." Mr. Dodge concluded that half a loaf was better than no bread, and he agreed to the proffered terms. By the next mail, I received this brief letter from Mrs. Bruce. "I'm rejoiced to tell you that the money for your freedom has been paid to Mr. Dodge. Come home tomorrow. I long to see you and my sweet babe." My brain reeled as I read these lines. A gentleman near me said, "It's true. I have seen the bill of sale." The bill of sale. Those words struck me like a blow. So I was sold at last, a human being sold in the free city of New York. The bill of sale is on record, and future generations will learn from it that women were articles of traffic in New York, late in the 19th century of the Christian religion. It may hereafter prove a useful document to antiquaries who are seeking to measure the progress of civilization in the United States. I well know the value of that bit of paper, but much as I love freedom, I do not like to look upon it. I am deeply grateful to the generous friend who procured it, but I despise the miscreant who demanded payment for what never rightfully belonged to him or his. I had objected to having my freedom bought, yet I must confess that when it was done, I felt as if a heavy load had been lifted from my weary shoulders. When I rode home in the cars, I was no longer afraid to unveil my face and look at people as they passed. I should have been glad to have met Daniel Dodge himself, to have had him seen me and known me, that he might have mourned over the untoward circumstances which compelled him to sell me for $300. When I reached home, the arms of my benefactress were thrown round me, and our tears mingled. As soon as she could speak, she said, "Oh, Linda, I'm so glad it's all over. You wrote to me as if you thought you were going to be transferred from one owner to another. But I did not buy you for your services. I should have done just the same if you had been going to sail for California tomorrow. I should, at least, have the satisfaction of knowing that you left me a free woman." My heart was exceedingly full. I remembered how my poor father had tried to buy me when I was a small child and how he had been disappointed. I hoped his spirit was rejoicing over me now. I remembered how my good old grandmother had laid up her earnings to purchase me in later years, and how often her plans had been frustrated. How that faithful, loving old heart would leap for joy if she could look on me and my children now that we were free. My relatives had been foiled in all their efforts, but God had raised me up a friend among strangers who had bestowed on me the precious, long-desired boon. Friend. It is a common word, often lightly used. Like other good and beautiful things, it may be tarnished by careless handling. But when I speak of Mrs. Bruce as my friend, the word is sacred. My grandmother lived to rejoice in my freedom, but not long after a letter came with a black seal. She had gone where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest. Time passed on, and a paper came to me from the South, containing an obituary notice of my Uncle Philip. It was the only case I ever knew of such an honor conferred upon a colored person. It was written by one of his friends and contained these words, "Now that death has laid him low, they call him a good man and a useful citizen." But what are eulogies to the black man when the world has faded from his vision? It does not require man's praise to obtain rest in God's kingdom. So they called a colored man a citizen. Strange words to be uttered in that region. Reader, my story ends with freedom, not in the usual way with marriage. I and my children are now free. We are as free from the power of slaveholders as are the white people of the North. And though that, according to my ideas, is not saying a great deal, it is a vast improvement in my condition. The dream of my life is not yet realized. I do not sit with my children in a home of my own. I still long for a hearthstone of my own, however humble. I wish it for my children's sake far more than for my own. But God so orders circumstances as to keep me with my friend, Mrs. Bruce. Love, duty, gratitude also bind me to her side. It is a privilege to serve her, who pities my oppressed people, and who has bestowed the inestimable boon of freedom on me and my children. It has been painful to me, in many ways, to recall the dreary years I passed in bondage. I would gladly forget them if I could. Yet the retrospection is not altogether without solace, for with those gloomy recollections come tender memories of my good old grandmother, like light fleecy clouds floating over a dark and troubled sea. This has been an Audible Incorporated presentation of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by herself. Written by Harriet Ann Jacobs. Narrated by Jean Barrett.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.